ॐ असतो मा सत्कमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मा अमृतंगमय ॐ शांति शांति शांति। लॉर्ड लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल, लीड अस फ्रॉम इग्नोरेंस टू इल्यूमिनेशन, लीड अस फ्रॉम डेथ टू इमोर्टैलिटी। ॐ पीस 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 बी अनटू ऑल। इन आवर लास्ट क्लास we said that the Vedic mass has been divided into four parts by Vedavyasa, and these came to be known as the four Vedas: Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda and Atharvaveda. Now again, each of these Vedas have been divided into further four parts. These are called the Samhita, the Brahmana, the Aranyaka and the Upanishad. Why this particular division? It's a spiritual evolution. First, man tries to understand. Then he tries to put it into practice. It is more physical, gross. Then when he becomes a little bit old, he retires and then he tries to direct his attention inward, more of reflection, meditation, and then comes a stage when he is absolutely disinterested in anything external and completely concentrates on the reality, on God. So, as the life of a human being is also divided according to this evolutionary rule into four stages: the student, the married and the retired, and one then last stage, the stage of one who renounces everything. Now this evolution does not take place automatically. It is not that as soon as a person completes his studies, immediately he is fit to be a householder or practice. There are so many people whom Swamiji used to call mustached babies. There are so many old people who used to play cards or go on talking fishy matters. Sri Ramakrishna used to get terribly annoyed about them. There are so many people who take monastic vows but are utterly unfit to lead that kind of life. Sometimes the first stage, the student life, may last many, many lives, and then only one becomes fit to enter into this world. By married life, I do not mean that everyone should get married. By married life is meant the fitness to enter into society. Most of the men or women are animals. They enter without understanding. They have absolutely no desire to follow the moral rules and regulations. They are irrational and they spend their time like that. But you know, we think that just because we are grown up, we are in a position to dictate to other people. So the Vedic scheme of life is, first one must understand. How does this understanding come? Where from does it come? It comes from, primarily, from three sources. One is from the parents, from the teachers, and tradition. Second, understanding the scriptures. Scriptures as interpreted by tradition, by the authorities. Nowadays, you know, there is so much of rebellion against authority, parental authority, institutional authority, religious authority, anything that smacks of authority, rebel against it. That's the most irrational way one acquires the fitness to rebel only when one first follows all the authorities, of course rational authority we mean, then one gets out of that authority circle. One cannot simply rebel and run away. It must be a natural evolution. What Sri Ramakrishna used to say, when the palm tree grows up, many of its early leaves, they just fall off. They just leave a small mark behind. Similarly, evolution must be a most natural way. So, the third one is the parents or the teachers who really live the life. I said, a student has a wonderful education when he gets these three wonderful sources, the tradition, the parents, the teachers, then the scriptures. Then, if he is very fortunate to come across some experienced people who are actually practicing it. So here also we see why people rebel against authority. Because parents, church leaders, religious leaders go on talking about peace, about moral life, and they are the most immoral people in the world. There was a college professor, he was a professor of morals, but he was the most immoral man. So his students asked him, how is it that you teach morals, but you are a most immoral person? And he said, have you seen signboards on the roadside? Walk this way, is written on the signboards. Have you ever seen the boards walking themselves? I am like that. So quoting scriptures will not do. They have to lead the life. Then a student becomes fit to enter into society. Only then a collection of such people who enter after acquiring right understanding about life, they are fortunate to gain real understanding by coming into contact with people who are really practicing, then they also have a desire to practice. Such a society is a most marvelous society. That is what is called a utopian world. So this student, he knows what is the goal of life, and he has also a direction how to put them into practice. Then he gets married and he leads a normal life, because even these students, they have worldly desires, and therefore they have to get married, fulfill those desires in a legitimate way, scripture ordained way. They are called grihasthas. Sanskrit, a married person is called a grihastha. A grihastha is not one who has a griha. Griha means a house. Everybody who has a house doesn't become a householder. Everybody who is married is not a good householder. If he discharges his duties properly, then he evolves further. His desires are fulfilled, and he leads a most full, a life of fulfillment. That is what is meant by a householder's life. It's not an unfulfilled life. Go on running riot, running after every man is running after woman, woman is running after man, and both of them are running after something else. If they lead a proper life of fulfilling their desires legitimately, scripture ordained way, their mind is ready to enter inside themselves. Then that is called vanaprasthashrama. Retired means not merely retiring. Indian politicians, you know, on every occasion they resign. Some journalist has put it, you know what resigning means? Resign. So what does an old man do who is not fit? He'll be playing cards. That's what Sri Ramakrishna had found. He used to scold the priests, that are you not old enough to think of God now? Don't you think death is going to come to you? Then, through sustained meditation, prayer, austerity, then the man's mind is purged of all worldly desires. His mind is intensely longing for God-realization, self-realization, for self-knowledge. That is the last stage, which is called sannyasa. So this is the Vedic ideal of an ideal life, ideal human life. This is based on rationality, reason, and it is an evolutionary process. It is not merely a formal process. So a student, he prays, he tries to understand the scriptures and is guided by the parents. That is what the Samhita portion of the Vedas is meant for him. Then when he enters into the society as a married person, then the Brahmana, or how to perform rituals, how to conduct oneself, how to interact with each other. Everything has a time, a place. There is a time for prayer, there is a time for chit-chatting, there is a time for amusement. Everything has a properly allotted time. One must have tremendous discipline to follow, to practice these things. So for these people, it is the Brahmana which gives these directions. Then the third part of the Veda, which is called Aranyaka, or the forest treatise, is it gives a lot of meditations, how to gradually turn the mind to higher and higher states of consciousness. That is where the Aranyaka is direct. And when the person is purged of all desires, excepting that of self-realization, then he is fit to enter into the fourth stage of, which is called Upanishad. Now you see, the Upanishads are those books which contain that knowledge, and which is to be acquired only after a long struggle. You cannot simply buy a collection of Upanishads. You don't even need to buy nowadays. You can download from the internet all the Upanishads. But it will not help you in any way. You can claim that you have become a scholar. You can write commentaries upon that. You can give lectures upon it. But the truths remain so far away. They will be of practically no use. So this is the development. Do we see this in practical life anywhere? Yes. Every great soul undergoes these things. I will give the example of Sri Ramakrishna himself. Sri Ramakrishna's father, though he did not take to sannyasa, he was almost like a monk. But in Sri Ramakrishna's life, we see these things practically enacted. There is a way of studying the life of Sri Ramakrishna through this view of, through this Vedic view. What was he doing when he was young? There were two things that were found out in his life. First, when he was young, he was absolutely truthful. He would never deviate from truth. Second, he was not what we call a blind believer. He always demanded to know, what is the reason why I should behave like this? What is the rationality behind it? Only after proper understanding, he would act according to the instructions, not otherwise. And he had this marvelous tradition of how to conduct oneself from his father, from his mother. They were the greatest teachers. He did not go to any guru to understand. In fact, he rejected all academic education as useless knowledge. But his own father and mother acted as his gurus. And they were persons who were practicing in life what they taught to their children. Each of their children have become a unique person. You have not read much about the other brothers of Sri Ramakrishna. Did you? Sri Ramakrishna had another two elder brothers. He was the youngest son. He had two sisters. All these five children became unique personalities. One thing common among all of them was, they were great devotees of God. By that, I don't mean a stupid type of emotional soda water bottle devotion that we see here nowadays. They were very rational, full of renunciation. I'll give one example from one of his brothers. His immediate elder brother, this Rameshwar. This Rameshwar was a married person, and he had a habit. If anybody comes to ask him of something, immediately he will give. Beggars, sadhus, anybody who comes to him, whatever comes to his hand, he will give it. His wife sometimes used to protest, "If you give away all these things, how can we manage our household?" He used to say, "Don't worry, God will look after us." That was his sustained faith, and he behaved like that. And when he, just before his death, he had a strange request. He said, "Take all my ashes and then put them, dig in the middle of the road, what you call four roads meet, you know, dig the place, crossroads, and then bury there." Now people didn't understand why this strange request. Then he said, "See, so many holy people and devotees walk this way." In those days, that was the main path by which pilgrims used to go to Ganga Sagar, a holy place, via Kamarpur. So many holy people, devotees, renouncing monks, they all walk that way. The dust of their holy feet, if it falls on my ashes, even though maybe a long distance, it doesn't matter. Holy dust has tremendous power. It can penetrate 6 feet, 60 feet, 100 feet. And I will become purified. You see, that is the type of life that he has led. Ram Kumar, what a wonderful soul. The whole saga of Sri Ramakrishna's spiritual life is enacted only because of this Ram Kumar. He was the one man who had devotion to God, who was so liberal and yet so rational, who interpreted the scriptures according to their right spirit. I'm not going into details, but if you read the life of Sri Ramakrishna, you will understand it. So, Sri Ramakrishna had that wonderful background, and he decided, "I will live like my father. My father is my ideal. My mother is my ideal." From his mother, he learned how to lead a simple life. By simplicity, did not mean only having few things, but innocent heart. Second, his mother was so loving that she would never eat without inquiring whether the neighbors had eaten. Whatever little she had, first she will see nobody is hungry, then only she will eat. So from his father and mother, Sri Ramakrishna's student life was formed. Truthfulness, rationality, fearlessness, tremendous memory, these were his greatest qualities, characteristics. Then Sri Ramakrishna was a married man. How did he conduct his life towards his wife? Even though he took the vows of renunciation, he became a monk. After he got married, he took sannyasa. He did not reject his wife. He called her, said, "Look here, let us both of us live like brother and sister." Now how was he living? 24 hours he was merged in meditation. His wife is spending 24 hours in cooking and looking after him, so he can meditate very clearly. He behaved like a wonderful householder. He was very rational about it. He even started calculating how much money is needed to look after my wife, and then he gave that money to Holy Mother. He took actively the task of training his wife. This is how we have to live in this world. He even asked her that, "Do you want me to lead an ordinary life of a householder? That means you want to have children?" It has a deep significance, though the devotees of Ramakrishna would say that of course she is Holy Mother, so she would never ask for ordinary life. She didn't. That's a different matter. Supposing she would have asked for, "I want children from you as my legitimate husband." Just a hypothetical thinking. Would she become any less holy if she had children of her own? That's the first question you think about yourself. So I'm not going to give the answer. Second, if she had asked, would he have rejected her wish? I am sure he would not, because he has promised, "If you want children, I will give you the children." But he said, "Why do you long for ordinary children? I will give you extraordinary children, jewels. and not one or two. Hundreds and thousands I will give you. That she accepted, that's a separate issue. But he was prepared on his own. Why did he do that? Because he realized that I may be a husband. My wife is not a slave. She is a partner. So both of us have to come to a right understanding, agree on certain issues, both of us in common, and we will proceed from there. How many husbands are ready to do this? If only 100th of or 1,000th of this, if understanding is there between any husband and wife, so much of divorce and separation and murders and these things would not have taken place. We are not talking about spiritual life, we are talking even ordinary life in society. Would be a much better life, much happier life, if this example is followed. What was Sri Ramakrishna doing? He was practicing prayer, puja, whatever job it was, he was doing it perfectly until he became physically incapacitated. He did not neglect his duties in the name of spirituality or I am a monk, I will not do all those things. He was doing everything. Then what was he doing? Of course, because he was in incarnation, all these stages have taken place quickly. This evolution has taken place very quickly. As soon as he finished his allotted duties, he used to retire into the nearby jungle, and there he used to sit and concentrate on God. Of course, his mind was absolutely pure. He had that tremendous longing for realizing God. That is what is called sannyasa. Suppose Sri Ramakrishna had never taken formal monastic vows, would he not have been a sannyasin? Who was a greater sannyasin than him? Even though he took monastic vows as an idea, but if he had not taken, he would have been equally the greatest monk in this world. This is the illustration that we see the Vedic scheme of life. Another thing we have to understand, before we can take up a sincere study of the Upanishads, there are so many people who look down upon the processes that are in the Vedas. Vedas are divided again from another angle into three parts. The Karma Kanda, the ritualistic portion, then Upasana Kanda, the meditation portion, and the Jnana Kanda, the knowledge portion. This is not arbitrary division. It is not something which is not connected with each other, but it is an spiritual evolution. First one must perform rituals. How long should we perform rituals? When can we be free from rituals? Ritual means, it is a wonderful word, this word ritual. We all do work. If we do work, it will give just that result. But if we do the same work as a ritual, it becomes a sacrament. What is a ritual? Ritual is that technique of transforming any action into something sacred. You eat banana, or a fruit, or a sweet. That is an action. It gives that result. But take the same fruit or sweet and offer it to the Lord, to your chosen deity, pray for some time, and then eat it as his prasada. It becomes a ritual. And you are going on, drumming your hands on the table. That is an action. So why don't you go and ring the bell in the puja room? That becomes a ritual. You use flowers. Why not offer them, decorate the shrine? That becomes a ritual. Any action becomes a ritual when God is connected with it. When it is transformed into something sacred. So what is the result of this karma kanda? After all, even a worldly person wants happiness. The performance of rituals has two results. One, it bestows happiness in this world and in the other world. And the second, through the performance of every action as a ritual, it purifies the heart. It makes our heart sacred, holy. What is wrong? You don't need to spend money. By money you can't make anything sacred. It is the attitude of sacredness. Then comes Upasana Kanda. When we are sufficiently purified of heart, then we become fit to undertake the next stage, which is evolutionary stage. Upasana means meditation. That is, the guru tells, or you can sometimes fix yourself, an ideal to be meditated upon. This is my ideal in life. Any form of God is an ideal. Every form of God signifies certain meaning. It's a symbol. Every form of God is a symbol. So, for example, if you are meditating on Buddha, what does he symbolize? Absolute peace, calmness, quietness. If you are meditating Jesus Christ, what is the symbol of? Love, compassion. If you are meditating on Krishna, what is the symbol? What does he symbolize? Karma Yoga, absolute detachment amidst every activity. If you are meditating on Rama, what does he symbolize? A life of righteousness, Dharma, is an embodiment of Dharma. Like this, every saint, every incarnation symbolizes certain ideals. When we meditate upon these forms are only gateways which transform our own mind and convert our mind or fills our mind with that ideology. We become embodiments of that particular ideals. So, the second stage is Upasana Kanda. The Vedas prescribe hundreds and thousands of types of Upasanas. What is the benefit of this Upasana or contemplation? Two benefits are there. One, it produces tremendous amount of detachment. Second, it produces perfect concentration. Upasana means concentration, perfect concentration. One cannot have concentration unless one has perfect detachment. Perfect concentration is perfect detachment. These are the two benefits that one gains when one goes through the second stage of evolution. Then comes the last stage. Then the mind is ready. Then the student goes to a qualified teacher. And the teacher tells him the truth. The truth about God, ourself, or the truth about this world. And he says, meditate upon this. Then he meditates. And he becomes that. Brahmavit Brahmaiva Bhavati. One who knows Brahman becomes Brahman. Here knowledge is not information. It is transformation. That is the Vedic scheme of evolution. So, Karma Kanda, Upasana Kanda, then Jnana Kanda. Now let us discuss about these Upanishads especially, or Vedas. When were they compiled or written? This business of writing or printing has come much, much later. It is only a few hundred years back. In those days they did not even know how to write. They were passed orally. That's why they were also known as Shruti. Heard. The students hear these Vedic truths or Vedic knowledge from the teacher. That's why they are called Shruti. At least 10,000 years back according to Hindus. Now we have to understand by this, not that this Upanishadic or Vedic knowledge started only 10,000 years back. As we discussed in our last class, Vedic knowledge is eternal. But some people discovered it. And this discovery also took place long past in, we do not know how many thousands of years back. But as Vedavyasa came and he codified, edited, and started to propagate them, that is what we are discussing. According to Hindu view, at least 10,000 years back. Some European Indologists assign the Vedas to the 12th century BC, others to earlier ages. Max Müller, for example, supposed the date to be about 1200 BC, but Hogg about 2400 years. Neither believed, of course, in the divine origin of the hymns. Another great Indian scholar, Balagangadhar Tilak, calculated from astronomical data and suggested that the mantras of the Rig Veda were brought together about 5,000 years before the Christian era, while according to the Orthodox tradition, the texts, even before their compilation, had been known to the rishis for unnumbered years. But the modern saga of the Upanishads is, in AD 1650, 50 Upanishads were translated into Persian under the patronage of Prince Dara, the son of Shah Jahan, Emperor of Delhi. From the Persian, they were translated into Latin in AD 1801 to 1802. Schopenhauer read and studied this Latin translation and in later years declared, "In the whole world, there is no study so beneficial and so elevating as that of the Upanishads. It has been the solace of my life. It will be the solace of my death." Now we have to discuss a short thing which is called Shruti and Smriti. According to Hindu understanding, there are two types of scriptures, Shruti and Smriti. Shruti means that which is heard. One meaning of what is Shruti, I just now mentioned, that it is the knowledge has passed orally from teacher to the student. The teacher tells into the ears of the student and he memorizes, that's why it is called Shruti. We hear it and learn it. But the real meaning of the Shruti is the sages who meditated and discovered these truths. Shruti means to hear, that which is heard. It is no physical sound. It is something which spontaneously flashes in the hearts of the people. Vedas are called the Shrutis, divine revelation. All other scriptures which are based on these Vedas are called Smriti. Smriti means that which is based upon the understanding of the Vedas. For example, Sri Ramakrishna's teachings are Shruti, because he had intuited all these truths. Swami Vivekananda, in a way you can say, has commented upon them. Though his experience was there at the back of it, you can call it as Smriti. If you study the works of Swami Vivekananda, you will see that it's a wonderful commentary on the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna. So all other scriptures like Bhagavad Gita, for example, Mahabharata, Ramayana, mythologies, Dharma Shastras, codes of conduct, all these are called Smriti. Smriti means memory. Memory means understanding. I hear the truth from somebody, then I understand it, then I give a big lecture on it, and that becomes a Smriti. If I am a great person, then you will record it and hear it 100 times. Now if I am not so great, you will hear 5-6 words and then change the channel. Make it some other channel. There are three important scriptures. One is these Upanishads. Second is the Brahma Sutras. Third is the Bhagavad Gita. These three scriptures put together are called Prasthanatraya. Three basic canonical scriptures of Hinduism. All the religious ideas that Hindus have up till this time, they are all based upon these three. The teachings of the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita constitute Vedanta or Prasthanatraya. These three books are considered as the foundational scriptures of Hinduism. Based on these three scriptures, different schools of philosophy, means different understanding, different interpretation of these scriptures, has produced different schools of philosophy. But all the schools of Indian philosophy can be divided into three categories: dualism, qualified non-dualism, and non-dualism, dvaita, visishta advaita, and advaita. Three great teachers of these philosophies were there: Shankaracharya, many of you must have heard his name, Ramanuja, a few of you must have heard his name, and Madhvacharya, very few of you must have heard his name. These were the great founders of these schools of philosophy. They were not really the persons who discovered these truths, but they were the interpreters of these three scriptures. Now, what is the subject matter dealt in the Upanishads, which concerns us very much? That's why we have all come here. What do these Upanishads deal about really? In the Upanishads we see that there is one emphasis on one subject only. That is, how to make man eternally happy. The rest is commentary. Knowledge of three things is discussed in great detail in the Upanishads. Who am I? What is this world? Is there a God? And their interrelationship. Who am I? What is this world? Is there a God? If there is a God, what is the relationship between me and the world, between God and the world? That is the subject matter. The Upanishads deal with creation, the law of karma, afterlife, rebirth, etc. The Upanishads teach the truth unknown to the sense organs regarding living beings, the universe and God. They describe the nature and attributes of Brahman, its reality and manifestations, its powers and aspects. They also describe the creation, preservation and ultimate dissolution of the universe and the changes and modifications of nature. Furthermore, the Upanishads deal with the development of the individual soul, its evolution and its destiny, its bondage and its freedom. The relationship between matter and spirit, between God, the universe and the living beings also belongs to the subject matter of the Upanishads. Is there a soul apart from the body? What happens to the soul after the death of the body? If a soul survives the destruction of the body, does it ever return to earth? Is a man responsible for his good and bad action? What is the goal and purpose of human life? These are some of the questions that are discussed. Our conduct and work depend upon these answers to these questions. And yet, we cannot answer them rationally, intelligently, with an intellect aided only by the senses. If we all know, and we look at the newspapers, what a terrible thing is going on in India, in Middle East, in America, in Afghanistan, here, in Ireland, everywhere. In the families, in the offices, in society. Why do people behave like this? Why do they fight each other? On one side they proclaim they believe in God and they are the greatest followers of their God, their religion. And on the other side they do not mind cutting down their own throats, other throats, leading to so much of strife, so much of chaos, so much of destruction. Why do people really behave like this? It is said that every man is a philosopher, whether he knows it or not. A materialistic philosopher is one who believes in matter. A religious person is one who believes in God. We are talking about not intellectual belief, but absolute faith. Our faith, our belief, that dictates our actions. If we go a little deep inside it, we see that most of us claim to believe, but we don't really believe. For example, do we believe that there is a God? Because I'm sure most of you say, yes, we believe in God. And is he here? Yes, he is here. You know, one small boy was very fond of eating cookies. And he was always taking from the tin where his mother kept made the cookies. One day the mother had to go out. She knew by the time she comes back all the cookies would be finished. So she called him, "Johnny, do you know God is watching you?" He said, "Yes, mommy, I know." And she went out. She came back. First thing, she checked the cookie tin. Some cookies were missing. So she asked, "Johnny, did you not say that God was watching you?" He said, "Yes, mommy, he was watching me." "And how could you take the cookie? What did he say to you?" "Yes, mommy, I asked him. And he said, 'Look here, Johnny, your mommy is not there, only I am here, take two.'" So if we really believe that God is here, how can we tell lies? How can we cheat anybody? How can we think of injuring anybody? Can we think of anything if we really believe that God is here? It's impossible. Why should we worry if God is there? Why should we think about what is going to happen in future if God is there? We do not have that much of faith. We have to develop that faith. No doubt some faith we have. But this faith is like muscles. Just as muscle power can be developed, faith power also can be developed. How do you develop muscle power? By exercise. So how do you develop faith? Through right actions, right conduct. So these people who fight and kill and cheat, do everything in the name of God, they do not really believe in God. And even if one doesn't believe in God, rationality, reason dictates to us, certain type of conduct is absolutely inimical to our own welfare. If I burn your house, tomorrow you will burn my house or somebody else will do it. I can't protect myself all the time, so we have to help each other. Even this rationality is lost. So, how do we know that there is a God? We don't know. No microscope can reveal it. Do we know what are the results of our actions? If we do certain things now, then the result will come. Will it really come? I don't see the result now. I have done so much good. There are so many good people. They have never done any evil action. And yet they are suffering so much. There are so many wicked people. And they are doing all sorts of wicked things. And they are jolly, well enjoying this life. Doubts come. But then what? Who can give you the right answers? If we only knew what results our actions would bring to us in future. Just imagine, supposing a wicked man, he can be given a video. You see, if you couldn't behave like this, this is what is going to happen to you after some time. Do you think he will do it? He will never do it. And on the other side, if he is shown, if you behave this way, you will be enjoying wonderful life later on. Then everybody will do it. But these answers cannot be got from ordinary sense organs. Even you can go to the edge of the universe, you will not get the answers. That's why we have to have faith. This is what the Upanishads are going to deal with. Again, does God exist? Is God just and compassionate? This is a great question that comes. Many people say they believe in God. And the doubt comes, what is this God doing? Why is he not stopping this Middle East war? Why is he not making everything heavenly? If he is compassionate, why is he allowing so much of suffering? Upanishads tell us, God is neutral. He is neither doing good, he is nor doing bad. It is human beings who create all this evil, suffering, or enjoyment. There are also people who are enjoying. Millions of people are enjoying. Not only suffering is there in the world, there is also equal amount of great happiness in this world, and we can enjoy that. If we earn, we must earn it. Nobody can make you happy. Nobody can make you unhappy. We have to earn it. It's a state of mind. If you bring very nice sweet meat to the mouth of a sick man lying in the hospital ward, do you think it will make him happy? It will make him more unhappy. That here is a thing available, and yet what a horrible thing, I can't enjoy it. Happiness and unhappiness cannot be bought, cannot be borrowed. It has to be earned by each one of us. Through our actions, our mind changes. If they are bad actions, then suffering is the state of mind. If we do good actions, then happiness is the inevitable result. So, does God exist? Is he just and compassionate? Or is he unconcerned about man, regarding him with indifferent eyes? Is God endowed with a form, or is he formless? Has he attributes, or is he without attributes? Is he immanent in the universe, or is he transcendent? Or is he both? Is the universe real or unreal? Does it exist outside man's mind, or is it a figment of his imagination? Is the universe beginningless, or has it a beginning? Has the Godhead become the universe, or has he made it like a watch? Or is the universe a mere appearance superimposed upon the Godhead through an inscrutable illusion of some kind, like a mirage upon a desert? And if not, if the universe is not unreal, is it finite or is it infinite? These concerns relate to a supersensuous realm unknowable to man's everyday state of consciousness. Yet the weal and woe and the good and the evil of man depend in a special manner upon his knowledge of these things. For man is rooted in a reality far deeper than is apparent to the senses. So we see answers to these questions in the Upanishads. Now, speciality of Vedanta. There are so many religions, so many systems of philosophy. What is the speciality of Vedanta? There are three specialities of Vedanta. One, Vedanta, as we discussed just now, deals with these questions. Whether there is a God, what is the nature of man, what is the nature of the world, whether there is an afterlife, what happens to the results of our actions, etc., etc. But on no account do they insist upon us to be blind, just go on having blind belief, blind faith. No. The first thing the Vedas tell you is, be rational about it. If any truth is found to be irrational, reject it outright. But you have to understand what is irrational and what is intuitive. An intuitive truth is beyond rational mind, but on no account it is irrational. It doesn't go against our common sense. Second, the only way to understand any spiritual truth is to go deep into oneself. You cannot get it. Even if Ramakrishna teaches you the truth, you will not be able to understand it. You can hear it, you can believe it, but you can't understand it. If you want to understand it, you have to meditate upon it, go deep into it, and understand it. Third, understanding is not enough. You have to experience it. Come face to face it. Pratyaksha, direct experience. That is the only thing that can prove to you something is true. You may believe in God. It is perfectly rational. You can understand God is necessary. But until you see Him, talk to Him, and have direct experience, you have no right to say God exists. These are the three specialities. Be rational, go deep into yourself, and experience the truth for yourself. What a wonderful thing it is. Perfectly acceptable to us. Now there are so many Upanishads, and each Upanishad is trying to tell us different things. In a way, Bible is an Upanishad, Quran is an Upanishad, any great teacher, whatever he teaches, is an Upanishad, because it is the result of his direct experience. What Ramakrishna teaches, what Krishna teaches, what Prophet Muhammad teaches, what Jesus Christ teaches, are they different? Or is there a common unity? Here we are specially concerned with the Upanishads. Do the Upanishads teach different things? Or is there a common thread, a unity? There are two views, the Western view and the Indian view. According to the Western thinking, there is a lot of difference, that there are inherent contradictions, different opinions even on the same subject in the Upanishads. But according to Indian view, there is a perfect unity. Why does this unity appear to be so different? Why so many different interpretations, different understandings? Is there a reason behind it? Yes. First reason is, these teachings of the Upanishads appear as different because the same experience is described in differing language. You see, I give this example. Suppose there is a building and there are four rooms and four people are living without any connection with each other in these four different rooms. And these four different rooms have got windows, and people living in those rooms are able to see the outside world only through those windows. Now each window is of different color. What is the truth? So if they want to know what the outside world looks like, then they have to take the stairway and go to the roof. When all the four people reach the roof, then they know what the outside world exactly looks like. That's fine. But when they come down, because they have gone through a particular colored staircase, that is through the mind, when they come down, when they try to describe it, tell it to others, they have no option but to use a language, communication. Language means that which with which we communicate with each other. So if somebody knows only Urdu, but he had seen Brahman, in which language is he going to talk about Brahman? In Urdu language. If somebody knows Sanskrit, he speaks Sanskrit. Somebody knows English, he will speak English language. So if these four people meet by chance in a common room, TV room, over a cup of tea, let us talk about Brahman. And Ramakrishna will talk in perfect village Bengali patio. And Jesus Christ will speak in Hebrew. Prophet Muhammad will speak in Arabic language. And the fight starts. You are wrong. Of course, even if you say you are wrong, that will not be understood. Even if Ramakrishna says, no, no, don't quarrel, you are all right, they will be able to beat him. What nonsense are you talking about? It is the different media that appears to be different. This is what Sri Ramakrishna is trying to illustrate. Through a small illustration, there is a lake. It has four ghats from where water is taken out. The Muslims come and call that water as Pani. And the English people come and call it water. And the Indians come and call it Jal. And the Latin people come and call it Aqua. And there is a quarrel. This is not Jal, this is Aqua. So all the four are quarreling because of the different languages. This is one reason why the teachings appear to be so different. There is another reason. That is, the wise teachers teach the truth in different ways according to the understanding capacity of the students. See, a teacher knows what is the truth. But if he has to teach a child, he has to teach in one way. If he has to teach a householder, he will teach one way. If he has to teach a monk, he will teach in another way. He is not in any way diluting the truth, but he is trying to help them to understand so that they can grow. So that is why in the Upanishads we see dualism, qualified non-dualism, non-dualism. Then also we see the Karma Yoga, the Bhakti Yoga, the Jnana Yoga and the Raja Yoga. So there is a perfect unity. So here is the conclusion. For active people, the Upanishads teach Karma Yoga. For those of emotional temperament, they teach the yoga of devotion. For those of a strong will and skeptical, they teach the yoga of meditation. And for those who are intellectual, they teach the path of knowledge. But for all these common people, there is one common teaching, irrespective of what differing teaching the Upanishads are giving. Surrender, complete surrender to the divine. That is a common thread of all the scriptures in the world and especially Upanishads. Why do we need this knowledge? Why do we want the Upanishads? Before studying the Upanishads, we have to ask this question. We discussed it earlier in our last class for two reasons. One, there is no solution to all the problems in the world. This problem contains many problems. This world contains many problems. Is there a solution for all the problems of the world? Has anybody found out all solutions? No. If you have a headache, for example, there is a medicine for headache. But you may be having stomachache, and there might not be any medicine for that. Even now, so many people die of cancer. For so many varieties of cancers, there is no medicine even now. Second, there is no permanent solution. Suppose you have a headache. Yes, there is a medicine. But does the medicine cure your headache permanently? Temporarily, yes. One day, 2 days, your headache is gone. But again, it may come after 3 days. What is the permanent solution? cut off the head. That is the permanent. If you have no head, then there is no headache. If you have a body, there is no physical problem. If you have no mind, there is no stress, no strain, no problem at all. So go beyond body and mind. Then there is no problem. That is the eternal solution. That is what the Upanishad really teach you, to go beyond the body and mind. From the unreal, lead me to the real. From darkness, lead me to light. From death, lead me to immortality. This is the real solution to all the problems. We are living in an unreal world. We are ignorant and we are subject to death. Change means death, suffering. So, Upanishads is that knowledge which will take us beyond this. If a person really understands that this world, there is no solution, you have to go beyond the world. If a person has decided to do that, then he has to go to this Upanishadic knowledge and then acquire it, understand it, meditate upon it, realize the truth, then he will be free. So, certain qualifications are needed. You cannot simply go on studying the Upanishads. Of course, all our studies, like in this class, is a general study. Don't think that as soon as Upanishad class is over, you become Brahma. No. It is a good foundation. It is a good understanding. It is only a starting point. Certain definite qualifications are needed, both by the teachers who presume to teach it, and by the students who are eager to acquire it. What are the qualifications? This subject we will discuss in our next class, which would be, I think, on 28th. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.